Welcome to The Locked Room, stories from the golden age of mystery and crime fiction. I'm Mordell, and this week we have a story by a female author featuring a most ladylike detective, Miss Violet Strange, in Missing, page 13, by Anna Catherine Green. One more, just one more well-paying affair, and I promise to stop, really and truly to stop. But puss, why one more? You have earned the amount you set for yourself, or very nearly. And though my help is not great, in 3 months I can add enough. No, you cannot, Arthur. You are doing well. I appreciate it. In fact, I am just delighted to have you work for me in the way you do. But you cannot, in your position, make enough in 3 months or in 6 to meet the situation as I see it. Enough does not satisfy me. The measure must be full, heaped up and running over. Possible failure following promise must be provided for. Never must I feel myself called upon to do this kind of thing again. Besides, I have never got over the Zabriskie tragedy. It haunts me continually. Something new may help to put it out of my head. I feel guilty. I was responsible. No, puss, I will not have it that you were responsible. Some such end was bound to follow a complication like that. Sooner or later, he would have been driven to shoot himself. But not her. No, not her. But do you think she would have given those few minutes of perfect understanding with her blind husband for a few years more of miserable life? Violet made no answer. She was too absorbed in her surprise. Was this Arthur? Had a few weeks' work and a close connection with the really serious things of life made this change in him? Her face beamed at the thought, which, seeing but not understanding what underlay this evidence of joy, he bent and kissed her, saying with some of his old nonchalance, "Forget it, Violet, only don't let anyone or anything lead you to interest yourself in another affair of the kind. If you do, I shall have to consult a certain friend of yours as to the best way of stopping this folly. I mention no names. Oh, you need not look so frightened. Only behave, that's all." "He's right," she acknowledged to herself as he sauntered away. "Altogether right." Yet, because she wanted the extra money. The scene invited alarm. That is, for so young a girl as Violet, surveying it from an automobile sometime after the stroke of midnight. An unknown house, at the end of a heavily shaded walk, in the open doorway of which could be seen the silhouette of a woman's form, leaning eagerly forward with arms outstretched in an appeal for help. It vanished while she looked, but the effect remained, holding her to her seat for one startled moment. This seemed strange, for she had anticipated adventure. One is not summoned from a private ball to ride a dozen miles in the country on an errand of investigation without some expectation of encountering the mysterious and the tragic. But Violet Strange, for all her many experiences, was of a most susceptible nature, and for the instant in which that door stood open, with only the memory of that expectant figure to disturb the faintly lit vista of the hall beyond, she felt that grip upon her throat, which comes from an indefinable fear, which no words can explain, and no plummet sound. But this soon passed. With the setting of her foot to ground, conditions changed and her emotions took on a more normal character. The figure of a man now stood in the place, held by the vanished woman, and it was not only that of one she knew, but that of one whom she trusted. A friend, whose very presence gave her courage. With this recognition came a better understanding of the situation, and it was with a beaming eye and unclouded features that she tripped up the walk to meet the expectant figure and outstretched hand of Roger Upjohn. "You here?" she exclaimed in smiles and blushes as he drew her into the hall. He at once launched forth into the explanations, mingled with apologies for the presumption he had shown in putting her to this inconvenience. There was trouble in the house, great trouble. Something had occurred for which an explanation must be found before morning, or the happiness and honor of more than one person now under this unhappy roof would be wrecked. He knew it was late, that she had been obliged to take a long and dreary ride alone, but her success with the problem, which had once come near wrecking his own life, had emboldened him to telephone to the office and— "But you are in ball dress," he cried in amazement. "Did you think—" "I came from a ball. Word reached me between the dances. I did not go home. I had been bidden to hurry." He looked his appreciation, but when he spoke it was to say, "This is the situation. Miss Digby, the lady who is to be married tomorrow, who hopes to be married tomorrow, all hopes, who will be married tomorrow if a certain article lost in this house tonight can be found before any of the persons who have been dining here leave for their homes." Violet uttered an exclamation. "Then Mr. Cornell," she began.
"Mr. Cornell has our utmost confidence," Roger hastened to interpose. "But the article missing is one which he might reasonably desire to possess, and which he alone of all present had the opportunity of securing. You can, therefore, see why he, with his pride, the pride of a man not rich, engaged to marry a woman who is, should declare that unless his innocence is established before daybreak, the doors of St. Bartholomew will remain shut tomorrow."
"But the article lost, what is it?"
"Miss Digby will give you the particulars. She is waiting to receive you," he added with a gesture towards a half-open door at their right. Violet glanced that way, then cast her looks up and down the hall in which they stood.
"Do you know that you have not told me in whose house I am?" "Not hers, I know. She lives in the city."
"And you are 12 miles from Harlem. Miss Strange, you were in the Van Brocklin mansion. Famous enough, you will acknowledge. Have you never been here before?"
"I've been by here, but I recognize nothing in the dark. What an exciting place for an investigation."
"And Mr. Van Brocklin, have you never met him?"
"Once, when a child, he frightened me then, and may frighten you now, though I doubt it. Time has mellowed him. Besides, I have prepared him for what might otherwise occasion him some astonishment. Naturally, he would not look for just the sort of lady investigator I am about to introduce to him." She smiled. Violet Strange was a very charming young woman, as well as a keen prober of odd mysteries. The meeting between herself and Miss Digby was a sympathetic one. After the first inevitable shock, which the latter felt, at sight of the beauty and fashionable appearance of the mysterious little being who was to solve her difficulties, her glance, which under other circumstances might have lingered unduly upon the piquant features and exquisite dressing of the fairy-like figure before her, passed at once to Violet's eyes, in whose steady depths beamed an intelligence quite at odds with the coquettish dimples which so often misled the casual observer in his estimation of a character singularly subtle and well-poised. As for the impression she herself made upon Violet, it was the same she made upon everyone. No one could look long at Florence Digby and not recognize the loftiness of her spirit and the generous nature of her impulses. In person she was tall, and as she leaned to take Violet's hand, the difference between them brought out the salient points in each, to the great admiration of the one onlooker. Meantime, for all her interest in the case at hand, Violet could not help casting a hurried look about her, in gratification of the curiosity
incited by her entrance into a house signalized from its foundation by such a series of tragic events. The result was disappointing. The walls were plain, the furniture simple, nothing suggestive in either, unless it was the fact that nothing was new, nothing modern. As it looked in the days of Burr and Hamilton, so it looked today, even to the rather startling detail of candles, which did duty on every side in place of gas. As Violet recalled the reason for this, the fascination of the past seized upon her imagination. There was no knowing where this might have carried her, had not the feverish gleam in Miss Digby's eyes warned her that the present held its own excitement. Instantly, she was all attention, and listening with undivided mind to that lady's disclosures. They were brief and to the following effect. The dinner which had brought some half-dozen people together in this house had been given in celebration of her impending marriage, but it was also in a way meant as a compliment to one of the other guests, a Mr. Spielhagen, who during the week had succeeded in demonstrating to a few experts the value of a discovery he had made which would transform a great industry. In speaking of this discovery, Miss Digby did not go into particulars, the whole matter being far beyond her understanding, but in stating its value she openly acknowledged that it was in the line of Mr. Cornell's own work, and one which involved calculations in a formula which, if prematurely disclosed, would invalidate the contract Mr. Spielhagen hoped to make, and thus destroy his present hopes. Of this formula, but two copies existed. One was locked up in a safe deposit vault in Boston, the other he had brought into the house on his person, and it was the latter which was now missing. It having been abstracted during the evening from a manuscript of 16 or more sheets, under circumstances which he would now endeavor to relate. Mr. Van Brocklin, their host, had in his melancholy life but one interest which could be called at all absorbing. This was for explosives. As a consequence, much of the talk of the dinner table had been on Mr. Spielhagen's discovery and the possible changes it might introduce into this especial industry. As these, worked out from a formula kept secret from the trade, could not but greatly affect Mr. Cornell's interests, she found herself listening intently, when Mr. Van Brocklin, with an apology for his interference, ventured to remark that if Mr. Spielhagen had made a valuable discovery in this line, so had he, and one which he had substantiated by many experiments. It was not a marketable one, such as Mr. Spielhagen's was, but in his work upon the same, and in the tests which he had been led to make, he had discovered certain instances, he would gladly name, which demanded exceptional procedure to be successful. If Mr. Spielhagen's method did not allow for these exceptions, nor make suitable provisions for them, then Mr. Spielhagen's method would fail more times than it would succeed, did it so allow and so provide. It would relieve him greatly to learn that it did. The answer came quickly. Yes, it did. But later, and after some further conversation, Mr. Spielhagen's confidence seemed to wane. And before they left the dinner table, he openly declared his intention of looking over his manuscript again that very night, in order to be sure that the formula therein contained duly covered all exceptions mentioned by Mr. Brocklin. If Mr. Cornell's countenance showed any change at this moment, she, for one, had not noticed it. But the bitterness with which he remarked upon the other's good fortune in having discovered this formula, of whose entire success, he had no doubt, was apparent to everybody, and naturally gave point to the circumstances which a short time afterward associated him with the disappearance of the same. The ladies, there were two others besides herself, having withdrawn in a body to the music room, The gentlemen all proceeded to the library to smoke. Here conversation loosed upon the one topic which had hitherto engrossed it was proceeding briskly when Mr. Spielhagen, with a nervous gesture, impulsively looked about him and said, "I cannot rest till I've run through my thesis again. Where can I find a quiet spot? I won't be long. I read very rapidly." It was for Mr. Van Brocklin to answer, but no word coming from him. Every eye turned his way, only to find him sunk in one of those fits of abstraction, so well known to his friends, from which no one who has the strange man's peace of mind at heart ever presumes to rouse him. Well, what was to be done? These moods of their singular host sometimes lasted half an hour, and Mr. Spielhagen had not the appearance of a man of patience. Indeed, he presently gave proof of the great uneasiness he was laboring under, for noticing a door standing ajar on the other side of the room, he remarked to those around him, "A den and lighted. Do you see any objection to my shutting myself in there for a few minutes?" No one venturing to reply, he rose and, giving a slight push to the door, disclosed a small room exquisitely paneled and brightly lighted, but without one article of furniture in it, not even a chair. "The very place," quoth Mr. Spielhagen, and lifting a light-caned bottom chair from the many standing about, he carried it inside and shut the door behind him. Several minutes passed, during which the man who had served at table entered with a tray on which were several small glasses, evidently containing some choice liqueur. Finding his master fixed in one of his strange moods, he set the tray down, and pointing to one of the glasses, said, "That is for Mr. Van Brocklin. It contains his usual quieting powder." And urging the gentlemen to help themselves, he quietly left the room. Mr. Upjohn lifted the glass nearest him, and Mr. Cornell seemed about to do the same when he suddenly reached forward and, catching up one farther off, started for the room in which Mr. Spielhagen had so deliberately secluded himself. Why he did all this? Why, above all things, he should reach across the tray for a glass, instead of taking the one under his hand, he can no more explain than why he has followed many another unhappy impulse. Nor did he understand the nervous start given by Mr. Spielhagen at his entrance, or the stare with which that gentleman took the glass from his hand and mechanically drank its contents, till he saw how his hand had stretched itself across the sheet of paper he was reading, in an open attempt to hide the lines visible between his fingers. Then, indeed, the intruder flushed and withdrew in great embarrassment, fully conscious of his indiscretion, but not deeply disturbed, till Mr. Van Brocklin, suddenly arousing and glancing down at the tray placed very near his hand, remarked in some surprise, "Dobbs seems to have forgotten me." Then, indeed, the unfortunate Mr. Cornell realized what he had done. It was the glass intended for his host, which he had caught up and carried into the other room, the glass which he had been told contained a drug. Of what folly had he been guilty? And how tame would be any effort at excuse? Attempting none, he rose, and with a hurried glance at Mr. Upjohn, who flushed in sympathy at his distress, he crossed to the door he had so lately closed upon Mr. Spielhagen, but feeling his shoulder touched as his hand pressed the knob, he turned to meet the eye of old Mr. Van Brocklin fixed upon him with an expression which utterly confounded him. "Where are you going?" the gentleman asked. The questioning tone, the severe look, expressive at once of displeasure and astonishment, were most disconcerting, but Mr. Cornell managed to stammer forth, "Mr. Spielhagen is in here consulting his thesis. When your man brought in the cordial, I was awkward enough to catch up your glass and carry it into Mr. Spielhagen. He drank it, and I'm anxious to see if it did him any harm." As he uttered the last words, He felt Mr. Van Brocklin's hand slip from his shoulder, but no word accompanied the action, nor did his host make the least move to follow him into the room. This was a matter of great regret to him later, as it left him for a moment out of the range of every eye, during which, he says, he simply stood in a state of shock at seeing Mr. Spielhagen still sitting there, manuscript in hand, but with head fallen forward and eyes closed. Dead asleep, or he hardly knew what. The sight so paralyzed him. Whether or not this was the exact truth, and the whole truth, Mr. Cornell certainly looked very unlike himself as he stepped back into Mr. Van Brocklin's presence, and he was only partially reassured when that gentleman protested that there was no real harm in the drug, and that Mr. Spielhagen would be all right if left to wake naturally and without shock. However, as his present attitude was one of great discomfort, they decided to carry him back and lay him on the library lounge. But before doing this, Mr. Upjohn drew from his flaccid grasp the precious manuscript, and carrying it into the larger room, placed it on a remote table where it remained undisturbed till Mr. Spielhagen, suddenly coming to himself at the end of some 15 minutes, missed the sheets from his hand and bounding up crossed the room to repossess himself of them. His face, as he lifted them up and rapidly ran through them with ever-accumulating anxiety, told them what they had to expect. The page continuing the formula was gone. Violet now saw her problem. There was no doubt about the loss I have mentioned. All could see that page 13 was not there. In vain a second handling of every sheet. The one so numbered was not to be found. Page 14 met the eye on the top of the pile, and page 12 finished it off at the bottom. But no page 13, in between or anywhere else. Where had it vanished? And through whose agency had this misadventure occurred? No one could say. Or at least no one there made any attempt to do so, though everybody started to look for it. But where to look? The adjoining small room offered no facilities for hiding a cigar end, much less a square of shining white paper. Bare walls, a bare floor, and a single chair for furniture comprised all that was to be seen in this direction. Nor could the room in which they then stood be thought to hold it, unless it was on the person of some one of them. Could this be the explanation of the mystery? No man looked his doubts, but Mr. Cornell, possibly divining the general feeling, stepped up to Mr. Van Brocklin and in a cool voice, but with the red burning hotly on either cheek, said so as to be heard by everyone present. I demand to be searched at once and thoroughly. A moment's silence, then the common cry. We will all be searched. Is Mr. Spielhagen sure that the missing page was with the others when he sat down in the adjoining room to read his thesis? Asked their perturbed host. Very sure, came the emphatic reply. Indeed, I was just going through the formula itself when I fell asleep. You are ready to assert this? I am ready to swear it. Mr. Cornell repeated his request. I demand that you make a thorough search of my person. I must be cleared and instantly of every suspicion, he gravely asserted, or how can I marry Miss Digby tomorrow? After that, there was no further hesitation. One and all subjected themselves to the ordeal suggested, even Mr. Spielhagen. But this effort was as futile as the rest. The lost page was not found. What were they to think? What were they to do? There seemed to be nothing left to do, and yet some further attempt must be made towards the recovery of this important formula. Mr. Cornell's marriage and Mr. Spielhagen's business success both depended upon its being in the latter's hands before 6 in the morning, when he was engaged to hand it over again to a certain manufacturer sailing for Europe on an early steamer. 5 hours! Had Mr. Van Brocklin a suggestion to offer? No, he was as much at sea as the rest. Simultaneously, look crossed look. Blankness was on every face. Let us call the ladies, suggested one. It was done, and however great the tension had been before, it was even greater when Miss Digby stepped upon the scene. She was not a woman to be shaken from her poise, even by a crisis of this importance. When the dilemma had been presented to her, and the full situation grasped, she looked first at Mr. Cornell and then at Mr. Spielhagen, and quietly said, "There is but one explanation possible of this matter. Mr. Spielhagen will excuse me, but he is evidently mistaken in thinking that he saw the lost page among the rest. The condition into which he was thrown by the unaccustomed drug he had drank made him liable to hallucinations. I have not the least doubt he thought he had been studying the formula at the time he dropped off to sleep. I have every confidence in the gentleman's candor, but so have I in that of Mr. Cornell," she supplemented with a smile. An exclamation from Mr. Van Brocklin and a subdued murmur from all but Mr. Spielhagen testified to the effect of this suggestion, and there is no saying what might have been the result if Mr. Cornell had not hurriedly put in this extraordinary and most unexpected protest. "Miss Digby has my gratitude," said he, "for a confidence which I hope to prove to be deserved. But I must say this for Mr. Spielhagen. He was correct in stating that he was engaged in looking over his formula when I stepped into his presence with a glass of cordial. If you were not in a position to see the hurried way in which his hand instinctively spread itself over the page he was reading, I was. And if that does not seem conclusive to you, then I feel bound to state that in unconsciously following this movement of his, I plainly saw the number written on the top of the page, and that number was 13. A loud exclamation, this time from Spielhagen himself, announced his gratitude and corresponding change of attitude toward the speaker. "Wherever that damned page is gone," he protested, advancing towards Cornell with outstretched hand, "you have nothing to do with its disappearance." Instantly, all constraint fled and every countenance took on a relieved expression. But the problem remained. Suddenly, those very words passed someone's lips, and with their utterance, Mr. Upjohn remembered how, at an extraordinary crisis in his own life, he had been helped, and an equally difficult problem settled, by a little lady secretly attached to a private detective agency. If she could only be found and hurried here before morning, all might yet be well. He would make the effort. Such wild schemes sometimes work. He telephoned to the office and... Was there anything else Miss Strange would like to know? Miss Strange, thus appealed to, asked where the gentlemen were now. She was told that they were still all together in the library. The ladies had been sent home. "Then let us go to them," said Violet, hiding under a smile her great fear that here was an affair which might easily spell for her that dismal word, failure. So great was that fear that under all ordinary circumstances she would have had no thought for anything else in the short interim between the stating of the problem and her speedy entrance among the persons involved. But the circumstances of this case were so far from the ordinary, or rather, let me put it in this way, the setting of the case was so very extraordinary, that she scarcely thought of the problem before her in her great interest in the house, through whose rambling walls she was being so carefully guided. So much that was tragic and heart-rending had occurred here. The Van Brocklin name, the Van Brocklin history, above all, the Van Brocklin tradition, which made the house unique in the country's annals, all made an appeal to her imagination and centered her thoughts on what she saw about her. There was a door which no man had ever opened, since revolutionary times. Should she see it? Should she know it if she did see it? Then Mr. Van Brocklin himself, just to meet him under any conditions and in any place, was an event. But to meet him here, under the pall of his own mystery, no wonder she had no words for her companions, or that her thoughts clung to this anticipation in wonder and almost fearsome delight. His story was a well-known one. A bachelor and a misanthrope, he lived absolutely alone, save for a large entourage of servants, all men and elderly ones at that, he never visited, though he now and then, as on this occasion, entertained certain persons under his roof. He declined every invitation for himself, avoiding even with equal strictness all evening amusements of whatever kind, which would detain him in the city after 10 at night. Perhaps this was to ensure no break in his rule of life, never to sleep out of his own bed. Though he was a man well over 50, he had not spent, according to his own statement, but 2 nights out of his own bed since his return from Europe in early boyhood, and those were in obedience to a judicial summons which took him to Boston. This was his main eccentricity, but he had another, which is apparent enough from what has already been said. He avoided women. If thrown in with them during his short visits into town, he was invariably polite and at all times companionable, but he never sought them out, nor had gossip, contrary to its usual habit, ever linked his name with one of the sex. Yet he was a man of more than ordinary attraction. His features were fine, his figure impressive. He might have been the cynosure of all eyes had he chosen to enter crowded drawing rooms, or even to frequent public assemblages, but having turned his back upon everything of the kind in his youth, he had found it impossible to alter his habits with advancing years, nor was he expected to. The position he had taken was respected. Leonard Van Brocklin was no longer criticized. Was there any explanation for this strangely self-centered life? Those who knew him best seemed to think so. In the first place, he had sprung from an unfortunate stock. Events of an unusual and tragic nature had marked the family of both parents, nor had his parents themselves been exempt from the seeming fatality. Antagonistic in tastes and temperament, they had dragged on an unhappy existence in the old home, till both natures rebelled and a separation ensued, which not only disunited their lives, but sent them to opposite sides of the globe, never to return again. At least, that was the inference drawn from the peculiar circumstances attending the event. On the morning of one never-to-be-forgotten day, John Van Brocklin, the grandfather of the present representative of the family, found the following note from his son lying on the library table. "Father, life in this house, or any house with her, is no longer endurable. One of us must go. The mother should not be separated from her child, Therefore, it is I whom you will never see again. Forget me, but be considerate of her and the boy, William. 6 hours later, another note was found, this time from the wife. Father, tied to a rotting corpse, what does one do? Lop off one's arm if necessary to rid one of the contact. As all love between your son and myself is dead, I can no longer live within the sound of his voice. As this is his home, he is the one to remain in it. May our child reap the benefit of his mother's loss and his father's affection, Rhoda. Both were gone, and gone forever. Simultaneous in their departure, they had preserved each his own silence and sent no word back. If one went east and the other west, they may have met on the other side of the globe, but never again in the home which sheltered their boy. For him and for his grandfather, they had sunk from sight in the great sea of humanity, leaving them stranded on an isolated and mournful shore. The grandfather steeled himself to the double loss for the child's sake, but the boy of 11 succumbed. Few of the world's great sufferers of whatever age or condition have mourned as this child mourned, or shown the effects of his grief so deeply or so long. Not till he had passed his majority did the line, carved in one day in his baby forehead, lose any of its intensity. And there are those who declare that even later than that, the midnight stillness of the house was disturbed from time to time by his muffled shriek of, "Mother! Mother!" sending the servants from the house, and adding one more horror to the many which clung about this accursed mansion. Of this cry, Violet had heard, and it was that, and the door, but I have already told you about the door, which she was still looking for, when her two companions suddenly halted, and she found herself on the threshold of the library, in full view of Mr. Van Brocklin and his two guests. Slight and fairy-like in figure, with an air of modest reserve, more in keeping with her youth and dainty dimpling beauty than with her errand, her appearance produced an astonishment which none of the gentlemen were able to disguise. This, the clever detective, with a genius for social problems and odd, elusive cases, this darling of the ballroom in satin and pearls. Mr. Spiegelhagen glanced at Mr. Carroll, and Mr. Carroll at Mr. Spiegelhagen, and both at Mr. Upjohn in very evident distrust. As for Violet, she had eyes only for Mr. Van Brocklin, who stood before her in surprise, equal to that of the others, but with more restraint in its expression. She was not disappointed in him. She had expected to see a man reserved almost to the point of austerity, and she found his first look even more awe-compelling than her imagination had pictured. So much so, indeed, that her resolution faltered, and she took a quick step backward, which, seeing, he smiled, and her heart and hopes grew warm again, that he could smile, and smile with absolute sweetness, was her great comfort, when later, but I am intruding you too hurriedly, to the catastrophe. There is much to be told first. I pass over the preliminaries, and come at once to the moment when Violet, having listened to a repetition of the full facts, stood with downcast gaze before these gentlemen, complaining in some alarm to herself. They expect me to tell them now, and without further search or parley, just where the missing page is. I shall have to balk the expectation without losing their confidence, but how? Summoning up her courage and meeting each inquiring eye with a look which seemed to carry a different message to each, she remarked very quietly, "This is not a matter to guess at. I must have time and I must look a little deeper into the facts just given me. I presume that the table I see over there is the one upon which Mr. Upjohn laid the manuscript during Mr. Spielhagen's unconsciousness? All nodded. Is it, I mean the table, in the same condition it was then? Has nothing been taken from it, except the manuscript? Nothing. Then the missing page is not there. She smiled, pointing to its bare top. A pause during which she stood with her gaze fixed on the floor before her, she was thinking, and thinking hard. Suddenly she came to a decision. Addressing Mr. Upjohn, she asked if he were quite sure that in taking the manuscript from Mr. Spielhagen's hand, he had neither disarranged nor dropped one of its pages. The answer was unequivocal. Then, she declared with a quiet assurance and a steady meeting with her own eyes of every eye, as the 13th page was not found among the others when they were taken from this table, nor on the persons of either Mr. Carroll or Mr. Spielhagen, it is still in that inner room. Impossible, came from every lip, each in a different tone. That room is absolutely empty. May I have a look at its emptiness? She asked with a naive glance at Mr. Van Brocklin. There is positively nothing in the room but the chair Mr. Spielhagen sat on, objected that gentleman with a noticeable air of reluctance. Still, may I not have a look at it? She persisted, with that disarming smile she kept for such occasions. Mr. Van Brocklin bowed. He could not refuse a request so urged. But his step was slow and his manner next to ungracious as he led the way to the door of the adjoining room and threw it open. Just what she had been told to expect. Bare walls and floors and an empty chair. Yet she did not instantly withdraw, but stood silently, contemplating the paneled wainscoting surrounding her, as though she suspected it of containing some secret hiding place not apparent to the eye. Mr. Van Brocklin, noting this, hastened to say, "The walls are sound, Miss Strange. They contain no hidden cupboards." "And that door?" she asked, pointing to a portion of the wainscoting, so exactly like the rest that only the most experienced eye could detect the line of deeper color which marked an opening. For an instant, Mr. Van Brocklin stood rigid. Then the immovable pallor, which was one of his chief characteristics, gave way to a deep blush as he explained. "There was a door there once, but it has been permanently closed with cement," he forced himself to add, his countenance losing its evanescent color till it shone ghastly again in the strong light. With difficulty, Violet preserved her show of composure. "The door," she murmured to herself. "I've found it, the great historic door." But her tone was light as she ventured to say, "Then it can no longer be opened by your hand or any other."
"It could not be opened with an axe."
Violet sighed in the midst of her triumph. Her curiosity had been satisfied, but the problem she had been set to solve looked inexplicable. But she was not one to yield easily to discouragement. Marking the disappointment approaching to disdain in every eye but Mr. Upjohn's, she drew herself up, as she had not far to draw, and made this final proposition. "A sheet of paper," she remarked, "of the size of this one, cannot be spirited away or dissolved into thin air. It exists. It is here, and all we want is some happy thought in order to find it. I acknowledge that that happy thought has not come to me yet, but sometimes I get it in what may seem to you a very odd way. Forgetting myself, I try to assume the individuality of the person who has worked the mystery. If I can think with his thoughts, I possibly may follow him in his actions. In this case, I should like to make believe for a few moments that I am Mr. Spielhagen. With what a delicious smile she said this. And I should like to hold his thesis in my hand and be interrupted in my reading by Mr. Cornell offering his glass of cordial. Then I should like to nod and slip off mentally into a deep sleep. Possibly in that sleep, the dream may come which will clarify the whole situation. Will you humor me so far? A ridiculous concession, but finally she had her way. The farce was enacted, and they led her, as she had requested them to do, alone with her dreams in the small room. Suddenly they heard her cry out, and in another moment she appeared before them, the picture of excitement. "Is this chair standing exactly as it did when Mr. Spielhagen occupied it?" she asked. "No," said Mr. Upjohn, "it faced the other way." She stepped back and twirled the chair about with her disengaged hand. "So?" Mr. Upjohn and Mr. Spielhagen both nodded. So did the others when she glanced at them. With a sign of ill-concealed satisfaction, she drew their attention to herself and eagerly cried, "Gentlemen, look here!" Seating herself, she allowed her whole body to relax till she presented the picture of one calmly asleep. Then, as they continued to gaze at her with fascinated eyes, not knowing what to expect, they saw something white escape from her lap and slide across the floor till it touched and was stayed by the wainscot. It was the top page of the manuscript she held. And as some inkling of the truth reached their astonished minds, she sprang impetuously to her feet and, pointing to the fallen sheet, cried, "Do you understand now? Look where it lies, and then look here." She had bounded toward the wall and was now on her knees, pointing to the bottom of the wainscot, just a few inches to the left of the fallen page. "A crack," she cried, "under what was once the door. It's a very thin one, hardly perceptible to the eye, but see?" Here she laid her finger on the fallen paper, and drawing it towards her, pushed it carefully against the lower edge of the wainscot. Half of it at once disappeared. "I could easily slip it all through," she assured them, withdrawing the sheet and leaping to her feet in triumph. "You know now where the missing page lies, Mr. Spielhagen. All that remains is for Mr. Van Brocklin to get it for you." The cries of mingled astonishment and relief, which greeted this simple elucidation of the mystery, were broken by a curiously choked, almost unintelligible cry. It came from the man thus appealed to, who, unnoticed by them all, had started at her first word and gradually, as action followed action, withdrawn himself till he now stood alone and in an attitude almost of defiance, behind the large table in the center of the library. "I'm sorry," he began with a brusqueness which gradually toned down into a forced urbanity, as he beheld every eye fixed upon him in amazement, "that circumstances forbid my being of assistance to you in this unfortunate matter. If the paper lies where you say, and I see no other explanation of its loss, I am afraid it will have to remain there for this night at least. The cement in which that door is embedded is thick as any wall. It would take men with pickaxes, possibly with dynamite, to make a breach there wide enough for anyone to reach in. And we are far from any such help." In the midst of the consternation caused by these words, the clock on the mantel behind his back rang out the hour. It was but a double stroke, but that meant 2 hours after midnight, and had the effect of a knell in the hearts of those most interested. "I am expected to give that formula into the hands of our manager before 6 o'clock in the morning. The steamer sails at 7:45. "Can't you reproduce a copy from memory," someone asked, "and insert it in its proper place among the pages you hold there? The paper would not be the same. That would lead to questions, and the truth would come out. As the chief value of the process contained in that formula lies in its secrecy, no explanation I could give would relieve me from the suspicions which an acknowledgment of the existence of a third copy, however well hidden, would entail. I should lose my great opportunity. Mr. Cornell's state of mind can be imagined. In an access of mingled regret and despair, he cast a glance at Violet, who, with a nod of understanding, left the little room in which they stood, and approached Mr. Van Brocklin, lifting up her head, for he was very tall, and instinctively rising on her toes the nearer to reach his ear, she asked in a cautious whisper, "Is there no other way of reaching that place?" She acknowledged afterwards that for one moment her heart stood still from fear. Such a change took place in his face, though she says he did not move a muscle. Then just when she was expecting from him some harsh or forbidding word, he wheeled abruptly away from her, and crossing to a window at his side, lifted the shade and looked out. When he returned, he was his usual self, so far as she could see. "There is a way," he now confided to her in a tone as low as her own, "but it can only be taken by a child."
"Not by me?"
she asked, smiling down at her own childish proportions. For an instant he seemed taken aback. Then she saw his hand begin to tremble and his lips twitch. Somehow she knew not why. She began to pity him, and asked herself, as she felt rather than saw the struggle in his mind, that here was a trouble which, if once understood, would greatly dwarf that of the two men in the room behind them.
"I am discreet," she whisperingly declared. "I have heard the story of that door, how it was against the tradition of the family to have it opened. There must have been some very dreadful reason, but old superstitions do not affect me, and if you will allow me to take the way you mention, I will follow your bidding exactly, and will not trouble myself about anything but the recovery of this paper, which must lie only a little way inside that blocked-up door."
Was his look one of rebuke at her presumption, or just the constrained expression of a perturbed mind? Probably the latter, for while she watched him for some understanding of his mood, he reached out his hand and touched one of the satin folds crossing her shoulder. "You would soil this irretrievably," said he. "There's stuff in the stores for another," she smiled. Slowly his touch deepened into pressure. Watching him, she saw the crust of some old fear or dominant superstition melt under her eyes, and was quite prepared when he remarked, with what for him was a lightsome air, "I will buy the stuff, if you will dare the darkness and intricacies of our old cellar. I can give you no light. You will have to feel your way according to my direction."
"I'm ready to dare anything."
He left her abruptly. "I will warn Miss Digby," he called back. "She shall go with you as far as the cellar."
Join me next week on The Locked Room for the conclusion of Missing, page 13, by Anna Catherine Green. In the meantime, beware of footsteps in the dark.